Hi, everybody. My name's Johnny Harris, and I'm still an alcoholic. And before I want to get into step 6 and 7 for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, into this program of action, this program of recovery that we're talking about, and have been talking about, basically the 2 steps. 6 and 7 are prayer steps. They're just 2 prayers, and they're supposed to be done right after you've taken the 5th step. The book has a suggestion that it follows. It says, returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. Taking this book down from the shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the 5 proposals, we ask if we have admitted anything, for we are building an ark to which we will walk a free man at last. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? He says that we can answer to our satisfaction, then we look at step 6. And I would kind of like to review what we've done already, you know, basically in the 1st step of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've admitted I am powerless, in total defeat. I have become willing to take my unmanageable life and place it in the hands of something else that could manage it a little better than I am. I have come to believe, partially probably, up to this particular point in my life, that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I've made an admission of insanity. I didn't openly do that, but it says I've done that. And then the 3rd step, I have made some type of a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. And basically what I've done in this, I have with my sponsor, as suggested in the book, I have taken the 3rd step prayer and done this. I have launched on a program of housekeeping. I have taken a searching and a fearless moral inventory of myself. And then the real hard part about this program of recovery, this program of action, is now that I have done this, now I'm going to have to start bringing other people into the game. Now I'm not going to be doing this thing all by myself. Now I've got to have to start bringing other people. And the first person that comes into this thing, after my course of action, would be whoever it was that I would take my 5th step with. Whether it's my sponsor or my minister or whoever it was. And we were talking about the 5th step a little bit today, and we were talking about it. One thing that I always do, and I neglected to say this, one thing that I always do when I'm taking a 5th step with anybody, I always share a little of mine first. I always do that. And the reason I always do that is because I want this guy to know a little bit about me so we feel a little bit more comfortable about it. Now, I don't know anybody who would do that but an alcoholic, you know, who would talk about those pretty sheep up in Butte, Montana or something to somebody else. I mean, it's not something, you know, some of these little things, some of these little secrets, some of these little humiliating things that I've never done, just to let the guy know that, you know, that I'm not going to sit there and he's not all alone in these little thought processes that he's had or whoever's done. And then when we've done this, after we've taken this 5th step, I suggest that the guy goes home and or the gal or whoever it is I've taken that 5th step with, and I suggest they do exactly to take this book down from the shelf, be quiet for an hour, because really, basically, what you're at right now, you're at a point where you brought some people into your life, and from here on out, with just the utterance of 2 simple prayers in my life, I'm going to have to start bringing people into my life. I'm going to have to start marching out there and clearing up the wreckage of my past. I'm going to have to start doing this if I want to live and be a free man and continue on to this thing. Now, there is a stumbling block in Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe, and I have seen it happen many times. And this is, And this is not an opinion. This is a fact based on my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. And people who get to the point where they've taken their fourth and fifth step in Alcoholics Anonymous sometimes seem to stop. They think somehow or other they've been launched on this broad highway. And the reason that seems to be is it's a lot easier than if you would get talk to these people. They would tell you that every year or so they go back and take another fourth and fifth step. Oh, I go back and take another in-depth inventory. I take another fifth step and blah, 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 blah. I'm getting into deep understanding. And the reason I suppose that people would do that is because it's a lot easier to redo something than to go forward. It's a lot easier to sit back and do something that I know ain't a big deal no more because I've already put this garbage out to bear once. I can only do so much. And it's always easy for me to uncover it again and uncover it and give it to somebody else than it is for me to pick up this little simple bag of tricks that I found out with this list of mine and go out and try to clear up the wreckage of the past. Now, this is, I don't know how it is with you, but with me, when I tried to make this list of my amends, I had this list already made when I made my fifth step. The list was already there. So I already knew who it was I had to make amends to. And some of them I had a tough time with. And the six-step prayer said, we have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted we are objectionable? These are things I did in my fifth step. These are things I uncovered in my fifth step. Can he now take them all, every one? If I still cling to some of this kind of stuff, I'm supposed to ask God to help me be willing to get rid of it. That's what I'm supposed to be doing. When ready, I say something like this: my Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you will remove from me every single defect of character that stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. We have completed step 7. Now, there is a little funny thing in here that I discovered 2 years ago when I was here with you, and I'll share that with you. In the chapter, How It Works in Alcoholics Anonymous, where it describes the 7 steps, he said, we were entirely ready to have God remove all our defects of character and humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. I read a different implication of myself, and I found a different implication in reading this 2 years ago here, and it almost struck me dumb for what I found here. It says, I pray that you remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Now, I believe that to be, for me, that God, I ask God to remove every single defect of character which will stand in the way of my usefulness to him and to my fellows. See, that tells me I don't even know which ones he's supposed to remove. I don't know which one it is. I really don't know. I know that that's when I have to start trusting him to remove from me all these defective characters. I don't know which one they are. But they're the ones, if I ask him and I have completed this thing up to this particular point in my life, he is going to remove the defects of character from me that will make me useful to him and to my fellows. And somewhere in this book, on the next page, it says, Our real purpose, the reason for doing all these things, my real purpose is to fit myself to be of maximum service to God and the people about me. Ain't that something? Now, how do I do that? Well, the first thing I got to do, it says here, now we need more action, without which we find that faith without works is dead. Let's look at steps 8 and 9. said we made a list of all persons we had harmed and we came willing to make amends to them all. Made a list. That's easy. I did that in my fifth step. I became willing to make amends to them all. I can be willing for 15,000 years. But somehow or other, I'm going to go out there and face the tiger in his den. I'm going to have to go out there and I'm going to have to look these people in the eye and say, I'm sorry because I've harmed you or wronged you in every way, shape, or form. And I had a tough time with that because at the very top of my list, the thing that was eating me more than anything else, there was two names. One of them was my baby brother. And my baby brother took an overdose of my dope when he was 17 years old, 1951, and died. And when I got sober, that thing damn near killed me, ate me up. I didn't know what to do about that. And my first birthday out of the penitentiary, I went out and I knelt by a grave and I thanked God that I had become all I ever thought I was. And then I did a very simple thing because a man told me to do a very simple thing. And when he told me that, I thought it was the stupidest damn thing I ever heard. He said to me, why don't you just write a letter to your little brother? I said, what? He said, write a letter to your little brother. Then I said to him, what would I say? He says, say all the things to him in that letter you would say to him if you were going to go make amends to him. I said, oh. He said, I said to him, where do you mail it? And he said, what difference does it make? Mail it. Just don't put any return address on it. So somewhere out there, I suppose, if I have any kind of faith, and I have come to believe in a power greater than myself, and there is a place that people like you and me go after we leave this place, and I believe there is. I don't know where it is because I don't know anybody's been there yet. I'm sure my little brother got the letter. I'm sure of that. And if he hadn't got the letter, at least he knows what I said to him. And then the second one on my list was my dad. I spent an entire lifetime, my lifetime, hating my old man. I hated my old man. My old man never did anything for me but pick me up and throw me around the room in drunken rages and tear my house up. And I hated him and spent all my life burned with this hatred. And the last time I'd seen my old man, I'm laying in a hospital in Topeka, Kansas, in Menninger's Clinic, kicking a habit. And my old man come to visit me, and he walked in there, and I spit in his face and told him, you get the hell out of here. And I don't think I did that to my dad because I hated him so much. I did it because I was so ashamed of what I was. And here's a man looking at his son, who he hadn't seen for a long period of time, and this is a thing that was spitting back up at him. And when I got sober and I came out of the penitentiary and I got out there and run around the world, I knew that somewhere along the line I was going to have to look him up. I didn't know where to look. But my mother has always kept in contact with those people. And so somewhere, I don't know whether I was 10 or 12 years sober, or shortly before that, when I was 5 years sober, I had made a point. I was going to go take a trip. I was going to put my, I had my two daughters and my wife at that time. And I was going to take him, and I'd made the arrangement to take a trip back to this little town that I was born in Lawrence, Kansas, to see my dad. And I had a trip all set up to go in June or July. Well, my wife committed suicide in April. And that kind of delayed that for a little while. But 3 or 4 years later, 5 years later, I got an address from my mother. I loaded my two little girls and this woman I was married to in this little car, and we took off across country. And we parked and headquartered in a little town of Topeka, Kansas, which is 30 miles from Lawrence. And I'm delaying doing this thing because I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it. I'm scared to do it. I don't know what I'm going to do, and I'm doing everything. I'm going out and playing golf and looking around and doing all. But the day came, I'd made a decision, so We got up that morning, we loaded the kids in the car, and we started driving 30 miles to this little town down there that I was born in, and I had this address. And I started getting close to this little town, and my head started to throb. My stomach became upset, and I felt like I was going to throw up, and I thought my head was going to explode. And we pulled into this little place. It was a little bar, and the name of that little bar is Johnny's. And this is the address I had of my dad. And behind this bar was a bunch of little boarded up apartments, and that's where he lived. And he wasn't in there, so I walked over and asked the guy unloading the truck if he knew this man. He said, yeah, he's sitting there in the bar. Now, I'm physically sick. I'm about ready to throw up. My head's about ready to explode, and I don't know what to do. And I walk into this bar, and here sits this derelict on the end of the bar stool. And I walked up to him, and I said to him, Dad, I'm your son, Johnny, and I came from California to introduce you to your grandchildren and tell you I don't hate you anymore. And he looked at me, and he said, you want a beer? And I said, no, shortly after the last time I saw you, I ran into a bunch of people who call themselves Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't drink no more. But we sat down at the table, and I brought the kids in, and they got him a Coke, and I put him in the car, this little guy with no socks and no teeth, and drove around to see my grandmother's house. And on the way back, I said to him, I said, Dad, why don't you let me take you to California? Why don't you come to California and stay with me, and I'll take care of you. You can live in my house. He said, no, take me back to where you found me. And so when he got out of the car that day, I gave him a picture of me and the two girls. And he stumbled off back into this little beer joint, and that's the last I ever saw of him, and he died just this year. Now, I'm still physically sick. My stomach is upset. My head starts to explode, and I feel like I'm going to throw up at any moment. And we got back in that car and we started headed toward Topeka. And the closer we got to Topeka, I started to feel better. And by the time I got to Topeka, there was no sickness in me. There's no headache. There's no nothing. And what I believe happened to me, I believe that the last little bit of poison, that bitterness and that hatred, which is poison, was in me, I spit out from me that day. And I had people tell me from time to time, why did you find it necessary to drive back there to make amends to your dad? You never did nothing to him. He was the one that did everything to you. It didn't make any difference what he did to me. I just hated him all my life. I talked bad about him. I denied him. I wouldn't have anything to do with him. And the last time, I didn't want him to die, thinking that what he sired was a thing that spit back up out of the bed. I had to clean that picture up. I had to change the picture. I think that's basically what you do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I basically think that's what the amend steps are about. I basically believe that the last impression we've ever left on anybody in our lives is what they carry with them until we change the pictures of it. That's why I believe it's so very necessary, why it was so very necessary for me to make that trip back to that little town, drive halfway across this country to see a little derelict sitting on a bar stool to tell him I didn't hate him no more, because I would not have been able to live with that poison. And I like to have believed, and it did me well to believe this, and it served me well to believe that every night when this little old man, after that, staggered up to his little old room wherever he fell out, there was a picture by his bed, and he looked over and he saw his son and his two grandchildren. And I like to think that from time to time that he carried that picture around with him, from time to time he said to his friends, this is my son and my grandchildren. They came all the way from California to see me. I like to think that. That makes me feel good to think he did that. I don't know whether he ever did it or not, but at least I gave him the opportunity to do it. And I'm the one who got all the benefits from it. I'm the one who took that poison and took it out of me and done all these things. And I don't ever know where all the grief or all the bitterness or all the guilt will ever leave me. I started last year with my wife, going out to the grave where my baby brother is buried and putting flowers on his grave and kneeling down there. And every time I do that, there comes a tear in my eye and a little feeling, a little nudge of guilt way down deep inside of me because I am basically responsible for his death. I didn't do it. He died because he wanted to be like me. He died because he was like a lot of kids must have thought Mickey Mantle was. He thought I was something running around in $300 suits, driving in big automobiles, living in them apartment buildings with them flashy broads and doing all that stuff. Man, he thought that was something. And it killed him because he wanted to be like me. And I had a tough time with that. That was one of the things that literally drove me into the pit of nothingness. It really beat me down to an absolute state of nothingness. It's really an amazing thing what they talk about on this thing. It's that you have already made the decision and an inventory of your gross or handicaps, you've made a big beginning. We get into action, we get to taking these things, and we get to doing this stuff. And the first thing you know, we turn around and we've been sober, and we're not sharing opinions anymore. I'm not sharing an opinion with you. I'm sharing an experience based on my own experience. It's a wisdom that's based on experience. If I were to share an opinion with you, it would be an opinion that I thought something might have happened. I'm alive and well, fully clothed and in my right mind because of the actions and the things that I have done in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because my loyalty is laid here, and I had somehow believed, because I was at the bottom of the road, that this would work. It says, you know, in this book it says, it is seldom wise to approach an individual who still smarts from an injustice to him and announce that we have gone religious. God, I've had people that I sponsor run out there, and every time they get sober, they run out and they say, everybody, God damn it, I'm sorry I stole all that money from you. I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous now, and I'm trying to get better. The guy said, that's real smart, Charlie. Did you bring me a check? Well, I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous now, and me and God are walking down the road hand in hand. And that's fine, Charlie. Send me the check. I really care. And then you will run into some of these people who really care. I ran into some of these people who really cared. I've sat down with people since I've been sober and made amends to them, and they really cared. And it's an ongoing process. But if you've never done it, it's hard to do. It ain't easy going out and leveling the pride and telling these people, I'm sorry I stole money from you, or I'm sorry I did this or I did that. There's a lot of discretion that's used in here, too. That's where the guidance of a sponsor comes in. That's why it's so very necessary to have a sponsor who's gone through this kind of stuff and who's constantly going through this kind of stuff to have this type of guidance. Because, you know, I'm like a bull in a china closet. Somebody tell me, man, you got to go out there and start making these amends. I'm not able to walk up to some guy and say, you know, I used to bang your old lady with regularity out there. Oh, that's real wonderful. Here's a bang for you. You know what I mean? It's real something. You know, we'd still in our anxious little God suits, you know, we run out there and then we can understand why they don't readily accept our amends. You know, so there's got to be a little discretion about this thing. And it says in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, that it doesn't make any difference. I hear that all the time from people. I had a guy I'm sponsoring, and he was telling me he got down to these steps, and he said he got this stepmother on this list of amends. And he was telling me about all these things that she'd done to him. You know, I mean, we always know what they did to us. You know what I mean? It's just, they just treated us so terrible because they just, he said, I think she ought to make amends to me. And I said, no. Uh-uh. You make amends to her. He said, I didn't do nothing to her. I said, you were just such a perfect little angel, that you just so wonderful that she was just happy to see you when you showed up. And we got to talking about it, and he was a holy terror around there. You know, they moved him in the house, and his stepmother and his dad are members of Alcoholics Anonymous and trying to stay sober. He's got a younger sister going to school, that's a real nice kid. And then they bring this tornado roaring through the house, you know, just eating everything in the ice box and throwing it all out and tearing it up. And when he wants one of the cars, he just gets in it and drives it off somewhere. But he was just not doing anything to her, and he didn't understand why she was upset about things like that. It's just absolutely amazing how blind I can be about the harms that I have done to other people. And so to protect myself and to pad my bed a little bit, you guys who play poker understand that, I'm sure, about padding your bet a little bit, about hedging your bet, making sure. I know you don't, Bruce. You're a little light in the pocket after that afternoon. you hedged it once too often up there, baby. I understand that, trying to draw them inside straights. But the deal of it is, if I think or have any kind of a hint that I have wronged somebody, my first action is to go in there and say to him, I'm sorry. If I harmed you in any way, I'm sorry. And it doesn't make any difference to me whether they've harmed me or not. It's necessary for me to get it cleared up. Oh, sometimes I like one to say, oh, no, it was me who was wrong. It was me. Let me tell you how you were really wrong, I would probably tell them. I would explain it to them in spades then, but it really isn't necessary, because no matter what they've done to me, this book and these steps and these things says I must clean up my side of the street. It's not up to me to clean up their side of the streets. Not at all. It's up to me to clean up my side of the street. And from this thing, to the best of my ability, I can walk down the street, on any street, in any town, in any state, in this union, and not be afraid to see anybody coming down the street. Not have to duck anybody, to the best of my ability, to the best of my ability and to the best of my knowledge. I have cleaned up the wreckage of my past, and I spend a great deal of the time cleaning up the wreckage of the present. When I harm somebody, I make amends promptly as I can. If I think I have, I just say I'm sorry. It hasn't been a month ago, that I have this large customer of mine. Matter of fact, he's the big daddy of my business. If he's gone, I'm gone. You know, one of them kind of deals. You know, and this factory who does business for me promised to deliver this thing up. And this guy has a great big meat packing plant out in 30 or 40 miles out of town, and he does an awful lot of business, and he uses a lot of my product. And this factory who was manufacturing this product for me was supposed to have these things delivered, promised me they'd have them delivered at 6 o'clock in the morning. At 6 o'clock in the morning, when they're not there, this guy calls me and gets me out of bed. He says, where are my boxes? I tell him they're on their way. And so I just get up, because I'm sure this factory, and I get up and I go to my office, and my secretary is sitting in there, and I pick up and call the factory, and I said, are the boxes? They said, oh, no, they're not going to go out on the truck till 10 o'clock. And I went absolutely berserk. I stood up and screamed and called the guy on the phone an MF. I walked by my secretary and slammed the door, and she said, where you going? I'm going to go kill them son of a bitches. And I got in my car, blind rage, drove 90 miles an hour down the freeways over to this factory. I got a little station wagon. And the guy's up there loading the truck. And I got up and pulled him off the truck and screamed at him and yelled at him and threw these boxes in my car. I'll deliver the goddamn boxes. Got back in my car, drove 75 miles, 95 miles an hour down the freeway, honking the horn, driving people out of the way, driving up and slamming the brakes and spinning around, almost run over two Mexicans. Opened the thing up and threw them boxes out and went in and sit down in this office, and it was trembling. I had been in an absolute and total rage blackout. Absolutely and totally insane. Now, you're not talking about somebody who only been to a meeting once in a while. You're talking about somebody who'd been to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every night for the last month, who is close to and active in Alcoholics Anonymous, who works with people, who is worked with, who has a sponsor. I'm talking about somebody who went absolutely and totally berserk. And it scared me half to death. Do you know what I did the rest of the day? I walked out to my car and told them two Mexicans, I'm sorry. They just looked at me and said, no mas, gringo. You know how they are. I said, fine. And I got in my car, drove back to my office, walked in and told my secretary, Carol, I'm sorry. I literally scared this woman half to death. She'd been working for me for 5 years, and she had never seen me raise my voice. And I had to get in my car, drive back to the factory, and find that Mexican truck driver and tell him I'm sorry. I had to go up to the sales service office and talk to the person I talked to on the phone and say I'm sorry. And I spent all day long running around making amends for these people. And what scared me more than anything else is, in that state, in that state of condition, with that much of an anger and that much of, if I had been in the wrong place at the wrong time and somebody would have handed me a drink, I could have probably drank it. I have no protection against anything like that and that type of an absolute rage. So it can pop up anytime. But then I had to go back and make amends because I could not have lived with that. See, I have a little funny little thing that happened to me since I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous is when I do something, whether it's that major or minor little thing, like slam the telephone down and holler at somebody on the phone, I get a little twist right there in my gut, and I can have a hard time living with that. I really do. And so I have to say I'm sorry. I have to say I'm sorry. I really don't know what I'm doing. And that doesn't make me wonderful. It just makes me a basic human being. I can't live with those kind of things in me. And I don't think any other alcoholic can live with them either. But supposing that I had never known what it's like to clean up the garbage of the past. Suppose it's never been necessary for me to go out and remove these skeletons from my closet. I wouldn't be able to walk down the street. Afraid I'd run into that Mexican somewhere that I almost ran off the road. I never have put one of those bumper stickers on my car, Easy Does It, or a friend of Bill W.'s, because I don't want somebody to know I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous sometime out there on the freeways. I'm sometimes crazy out there on the freeway. I don't know what it is about me. They seem to know when I'm tired out there, I guess. They're just after me from time to time. They don't know I've been to Manuka all weekend. They're just out there. This book is full of all kinds of things. It says, under no conditions, in this book. Under no conditions do I criticize such a person or argue. He says that sometimes it's harder to go to an enemy than a friend. It's easy to go to a friend. Sometimes it's harder to go to somebody I don't like. A few years ago, I was involved in a business venture with a couple of people, and it cost me an awful lot of money. Awful lot of money. And a lot of hard feelings. And somewhere along the line, I had to go to these people and tell them that if I'd harmed them in any way, I was sorry. And that wasn't easy for me to do. But what I had been doing is I'd been, and somebody would ask me something about them, I'd badmouth them a little. Not real bad, just little badmouth. You know, like, they may get drunk if they ain't careful. That's just a minor thing, I know. It's a major thing. But badmouthing, criticizing, critical, criticism, judgmental, those kind of things eat me up. I don't say, I don't do them. I don't say that. But the guy, they just twist my gut when I do them. And when I know that I'm not doing them, I don't do them as much. And then I have to go out and make amends. It's an absolutely, totally amazing thing. But it says in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, that whoever I'm going to is going to be more interested in a demonstration of goodwill than our talk of spiritual discoveries. And so many times I hear people go out and they talk that, you know, that, well, I was real bad and now I've found God and I'm in A&A and I'm saving souls, and so I want you to forgive me for all the wrongs I've done. And a lot of people, I suppose, but it says in this book that the people are going to be more impressed with my demonstration of my goodwill than they are about my talk of spiritual discoveries, about how wonderful I am and how I found God. It says in this book that we shouldn't use an excuse of shying away from the subject of God. When it will serve any good purpose, we are willing to announce our conviction with tact and common sense. The question of how to approach the man we hated will arise, and the question of how to approach him, it may be he has done us more harm than we have done him. And though we may have acquired a better attitude towards him, we're still not too keen about admitting our faults. Nevertheless, with the person we dislike, we take the bit in our teeth. It is harder to go to the enemy than a friend. And it says in this book why we should do these. It says we have to remind ourselves constantly when we're in this thing, we have decided to go to any length to find a spiritual experience, that we be given the strength and direction to do the right thing. We may lose our position or reputation or face jail, but we are willing. We have to be. We must not shrink at anything. I was sponsoring a guy one time, and we got to this part of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he said, I got something I really don't know what to do about. And I said, what was that? And he's from Oregon. He was in the penitentiary in Oregon. And I guess what he did when he come out of the penitentiary in Oregon, he just hung his parole on the gate and left. And moved to California, and he lived down there drunk and running around working in construction for a while. And he decided to get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. He'd been sober for a year or so, and he'd been out of the penitentiary for a number of years, I guess. And he was living with this terrible fear on him, this terrible fear that every time somebody knocked on the door, there was going to be somebody and they're calling in his marker, he's going to nail him. And he just terrified at that. And he was so terrified at it most of the time that he drank over it. It's a little simple thing. And we were going through his fifth step. We were getting into these things. We had this list that he was telling me about this thing. And I said, well, you're going to have to do something about that. And he said, well, what should I do? And I said, well, I really don't know. I said, why don't you write the parole board or the state board of parole in Oregon and find out what the disposition is? I said, if you want, I'll get you some letters of recommendation from attorneys and doctors and good prominent people in this area that you're a good upstanding citizen and have been sober for a little over a year and a half and you're working hard and you're married and you got a good family and we'll write these kind of things and see what's going on. And he didn't want to do that. But anyhow, he wrote this letter because the consequences of not writing it was greater than the consequences of writing it. Because he couldn't drink, because for him to drink was to die. He wrote this letter, and I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks went by, and I come home from work one day, and here he is sitting on my front porch. He's a big, tall, old skinny guy, and he's sitting on my front porch. And I got out of my car, and he ran, he picked me up, and he swung me around, he's all happy, and I said, "Jesus, man, what happened?" And he said, "I got that letter back from Oregon parole board." And I said, "Well, what'd they say?" They said they had discharged me from parole 6 years ago. Now here he had been running around for 6 years, absolutely stark terror. And he couldn't stay sober because he was worried about this one little situation, about them knocks on his doors, about them strangers in them three-piece suits walking up to him in them places. You know, I mean, that's scary. You know, standing there somewhere, because I lived that way, man. I lived that way when I was out there running the streets. Every time somebody looked like he was a policeman coming near me, I went the other direction. Just stark terror all the time. You know, I don't know how you were, but you're out there cutting them corners and you got a few things going for you and you got a load of that dope in your car and there's a police, you hear a police siren. Man, you just turn off the motor and just tremble. It's just, God, it just, God, it just, well, it's just the most magic thing. And it doesn't say that, you know, we have to do all these things. It just says that we have to do these things or else. It doesn't say we have to go to jail. We're sorry for what we have done, and God willing, it shall not be repeated. That's what this book said. More than that, we cannot do. We have no right to go further. There may be justifiable exceptions, and though we wish to lay down no rule of any sort, we have often found this to be the best course to take. We shall be sorry for what we have done, and God willing, it shall not be repeated. Man, that's a neat thing to say. I told somebody one time, he was worrying about his mother, and or family and something, you know, they didn't know how to make amends. He said, "I really didn't do much. My family didn't see him." And I said, "Well, you go to your parents and tell them that you haven't been much of a son, but you're going to be better from this day forward." You know, that's a very simple little statement to say. I mean, they'll know you're better. You know, I mean, there ain't no way for the people who are around us and love us to escape from our insanity. Even if we're not there, they know it. I mean, they do. You can live in another state somewhere or in another town and not see your people but once a year, and they know you're not right. I mean, parents and mothers and fathers have some type of an intuition about knowing that. They just seem to know. I know it. When my mother calls me on the phone, I know my mother's drunk. Nobody else does. My mother just calls on the telephone. Calls, and she doesn't get me. She gets my secretary. My secretary says, "Your mother calls, says she's drunk." And the reason that, if she calls up and calls my secretary, my wife. "How are you and John doing, Deb?" "My secretary's name is Carol." You know, but my mother dialed the wrong number. I know she's drunk. But it doesn't make any difference. They seem to know. It says in our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, our design for living is not a one-way street. It says in some cases, utmost frankness is demanded. It says a lot to do with things. It says the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. It says there's some wrongs we can never fully right, but we don't worry about them. We can honestly say to ourselves that we would write them if we could. Some people cannot be seen. And I just found out where my sponsor got that letter business. We send them an honest letter. See? Just hang around here. More will be revealed to you. I just thought he was awful smart to do that. He got that on page 83 in this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. We send them an honest letter. Now, I can't take credit for being that smart anymore. When I tell somebody that, I'll just say, well, it's on page 83. It says in the bottom of page 83, and this is the most fantastic thing I know about Alcoholics Anonymous, what it says to an alcoholic who has gone this far. And when you get to the bottom of page 83, they are assuming, I suppose, the people who wrote this magnificent book and this Design for Living, that we have been painstaking about this phase of our development, that we have done these things, that we have admitted defeat, and we have turned our will and our lives over to the care of God. We have come to believe that a power could restore us to sanity. We have made an inventory. We have taken a fifth step. We admitted to God. We've made this list. We've done these prayers. We've been out about the business of cleaning up the wreckage of the past. We've made our amends. They're saying that. I guess they have assumed that we've done this, because this is what they say. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor use to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. It says, no matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. Isn't that amazing?
Oh, it's you, Phil. I'm scared with Philip over my shoulder. I feel like, almost feel like one of them seagulls sitting up there. You know what they do from time to time. Oh, the moon. The moon man. The moon man. I don't know, but I'm glad I'd rather have it you up there than Mike. And at the end of these promises, when they say, well, I'll admit, materialize and work for them, it says this thought brings us to step 10. Now, they're talking about something has happened to me as a result of these first 9 steps. There used to be an old man in Alcoholics Anonymous by the name of Chuck Chamberlain who used to say that if you're not surrendered when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, you work the first 9 steps of recovery and you will be surrendered. Because what has happened to me and what had happened to me up until this particular point in my life, I'd been on a series of actions that was reducing my ego a depth. That I found out that God was doing for me things I couldn't do for myself. That I was experiencing peace and freedom and happiness and joy, the likes of which I never dreamed possible. For people like me don't live in joy. People like me who use, take, abuse, do not live in any type of peace or usefulness or any type of... I don't have any purpose in life. My purpose in life was to get loaded. Period. And if you had some money that I could use to get loaded on, I took it away from you. That was my purpose in life. Not to do about anything else. Not to clear away the record. Not to rub out the record. That's what I'm doing in Alcoholics. I'm rubbing out the record. That's what I did with that old man in Lawrence, Kansas, 10 or 12 or 15 years ago, however long it was. I rubbed out a little of the record. I made myself a little cleaner inside because I scrubbed my inside and took some of the poison out of my system. And you know, this is the honest to God truth. And I've been thinking about it as I was sitting here. As I look back over it now, do you know, actually, from that day that I spent with my old man to this very day, I have never felt or even thought or even said that I hate anybody. I don't like some people. I don't approve of some people, but the word hate is almost completely and totally left my vocabulary as far as pertaining to my fellow man. It's amazing to me. I just can't afford it. I can't afford that feeling and the bitterness that goes inside of me when those rages and anger and fits of anger and rage come about me, which are once every once in a blue moon. I'm so glad that I've got something to come back on. I never forget that. The day that happened, I had to talk at one of our groups at a workshop on the men's steps. That night, I had to go down and explain to my group that the great guru was human. Boy, they got a kick out of that, I'll tell you. It's really amazing. But I'm very glad to have an opportunity to rehash and to remember what happened to me as a result of this course of action. To remember that. Somewhere in our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, I think it's in the chapter Working with Others, it says something about to see this fellowship grow up around you, this is an experience you must not miss. And the only way I've ever found a fellowship to grow up around me is that I have to share my experience, strength, and hope with them. Not my drunkenness, not my war stories, or not my success in the material world, or how I've accumulated and moved on and become this, that, and the other. You know, I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to think that you had to get somewhere here. You had to go somewhere. You know, when I quit trying to get anywhere, I've been all over the world. I used to think when I was in Alcoholics Anonymous that you had to gather up things and get things and become something. And when I quit trying to get anything, I've been given it all. Because I have got it all. And when I think about this great course of action that I have embellished on and been working on and been moving in since I've been around you, and how you've shown me through your examples how these things have worked in your life. Because I wouldn't take them on face value. If you took this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, any layman who walked in here and took this book of Alcoholics Anonymous and read it, and you see these things, they would think, God, that's a wonderful thing. But it's an amazing fact to me that when somebody says to me, I used to be this type of a selfish, self-seeking, no good, rotten SOB, and I have embellished on this course of action for a certain period of time, and these things have happened to me, that gets my attention. Because I'll watch them and make sure it happens. And my old sponsor, God rest his soul, used to say one of the most magnificent sayings I've ever heard, what you are, speak so loud I can't hear a word you say. Isn't that amazing? So if I was you and me and anybody else, I would never sell Alcoholics Anonymous short. This old man that I used to love so much used to say to me, there's always as much ahead of you as there is behind you. I remember one time, and I went down to see him, and I had some type of a problem. I don't know what it was. I just had some type of a problem. And it was just a real heavy deal, I guess. I don't even remember what it was, but I know at that moment it was heavy stuff. And I went down to see him, and he was walking down along the beach. And so I went down there and walked along the beach with him. You know, I got right alongside of him. I'm walking down the beach with him, and I'm saying to him, I'm laying this heavy problem on him. You know, like, I don't even know what the problem was, but I know it was heavy. But anyhow, I've lent. And he said to me, he looked at me and he smiled and he said, "Oh," he said, "look out there." And I looked out there. I was looking out over the ocean. He said, "How far can you see?" And I said, "What?" He says, "How far can you see?" I said, "How would I know? I'm not a sailor. How far is it out there?" He said, "It's 7 miles to the horizon." I thought, the old fool's been in the sun too long. Don't he understand I've got this monumental problem that he better give me some help with? So we walked along and talked about nonsense or whatever it was, and finally we got up to his house, and his house sat on a great big hill and looked out, and on a clear day you could see Catalina Island. And so I got him out of the sun finally and got a cup of coffee in his hand and got him all settled down there, and so I laid this big deal on him again. He looked at me and smiled and he said, "Look out there." I said, "Okay." He says, "How far can you see?" And I said, "I got him now." 7 miles, I said. He said, "No, you don't understand, do you?" And I said, "What?" He said, "You see that point down there?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "You see that point over there?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "That point from that point to that point is 120 miles. I said, "The hell you say." And he looked at me and he could see I was dumbfounded. And he said, "You still don't understand it, do you?" And I said, "No, I don't understand what you're talking about. You're crazy. You fool, you're a babbling old fool. You're crazy." He said, "No, son. The higher you go, the further you see. And the further you see, the more there is to see. It's life infinitum." He says, "It's like looking at the sun. If you could see the totality of this program of ours, it would blow your mind and blind you. You cannot see it." I don't know how long ago that's been. I do know that the more I grow along spiritual lines, the more I see. And the more I see, the more there is to see. And the more I grow along spiritual lines, the more I see. Do you know that my life looks different today than it did 2 years ago when I was here? My life is an absolute thing of joy today. It's amazing. And I'm not doing anything any different. It's just there, that's all. It's really an amazing thing. The higher you go, the further you see. And the book, The Program of Alcoholics Anonymous, this book, this magic, magic, wonderful book of experiences, says that we grow along spiritual lines. Spiritual, not religious, spiritual lines. And a guy once made a definition to me about spirituality. He said spirituality isn't anything more than being wanted, needed, and loved. And I don't know which one of us was the most unspiritual when we came here. I surely wasn't wanted, needed, and loved when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And now from time to time, I'm wanted, needed, and loved. It's amazing. And so we ought to just get on about the business. And if you haven't done these things, if you're stuck on 4 and 5, or stuck on 3, or stuck on 2, or stuck on 1, get on with it. Get on with it. Get on down to business about this business of living. Clear away the wreckage of the past and give freely what you found and come join us. Something in this book written about that, isn't there? Join us in the fellowship of the Spirit. It's amazing. I ain't got anything more to say, so if you want to say something to me, I'll try to say something back to you. But it's magic. We're at step 10. So I'll let you ask questions. If you want to ask questions, I'll try to answer them. But I really want to thank you for letting me come here.
Mm-hmm.
No, it doesn't. send the child support payments. Yeah. Well, I don't see any harm in doing a little preliminary explanation about that phone to see what her attitude is. Then write her a letter. Don't put any return address on it. You know, but you got to do something. Obviously, it's bothering you, Danny. You wouldn't brought it up. You see, see what I'm talking about? It's sitting there. You know, it's something that you obviously have to clear up. See, if it's bothering you, you got to clear it up. That's the way we are. It bothers us. It may be, what bothers me, I have to clear up because it may be the thing that leads me back to drinking. Or using or something. You understand? It may be that one little thing that has me so out of kilter at that particular time that I take that drink I don't want to take. I can't take that chance. My life is in the balance. For me to drink is to die. Yeah. So if it bothers you, do something about it. Oh, there's not much you can do about that then. I mean, they don't have to accept it. Like I told you, it's not up to them to accept it. It's up to you to do it. Yeah, you have to accept that she won't accept your acceptance. You know? I mean, that's ego deflating. Really, it is. You know, here you are, you're launched on this sea of action and the spiritual way of life. And you're going out and you're trying to clear up the wreckage of the past. And then you walk in there and you try to make amends and they don't accept them. That's almost mind-boggling and it's almost a stumbling block. But by the same token, it's better that you run into these kind of things than to have everybody say how wonderful you are because you're doing these magnificent things and surely you must walk with God. Because you get to believe in that crap and that'll kill you. You get to believe in how wonderful you are because you're doing this and helping them so much. That's one of the big stumbling blocks with these men. People think they're going to go help somebody by doing this. Help me. This is the thing I had to get off of me. That's what I did. If she don't accept your amends, that's her problem. Let her have it. Is she an alcoholic? Well, then she don't have to worry about it then. Won't bother her too much. She just finds it really won't. She won't have to die over it. It won't bother her. They seem to be able to live with that bitterness. I can't. You can't either. Is that an arm or a foot? You're all well. Okay. Thank you. We'll have another session in the morning.